Rising Tide of Colour, Against White World Supremacy, by Lothrop Stoddard, Part 8, The Beginning of the Ebb. Now it is the Nordics who are most affected by the dysgenic aspects of our civilization. In the newer areas of white settlement, like our Pacific coast or the Canadian Northwest, to be sure, the Nordics even now thrive and multiply. But in all those regions which typify the transformation of the Industrial Revolution, the Nordics do not fit into the altered environment as well as either Alpines or Mediterraneans, and hence tend to disappear. Before the Industrial Revolution, the Nordics' chief eliminator was war. His preeminent fighting ability, together with a position of leadership which he had generally acquired, threw on his shoulders the brunt of battle and exposed him to the greatest losses, whereas the more stolid Alpine and the less robust Mediterranean stayed at home and reproduced their kind. The chronic turmoil of both the medieval and modern periods imposed a perpetual drain on the Nordic stock, while the era of discovery and colonization, which began with the 16th century, further depleted the Nordic ranks in Europe, since it was adventurous Nordics who formed the overwhelming majority of explorers and pioneers to new lands. Thus, even at the end of the 18th century, Europe was much less Nordic than it had been 1,000 years before. Nevertheless, down to the close of the 18th century, the Nordics suffered from no other notable handicaps than war and migration, and even enjoyed some marked advantages. Being a high type, the Nordic is naturally a high-standard man. He requires healthy living conditions and quickly pines when deprived of good food, fresh air, and exercise. Down to the close of the 18th century, Europe was predominantly agricultural. In cool northern and central Europe, therefore, environment actually favoured the big blonde Nordics, especially as against the slighter, less muscular Mediterranean. While in the hotter south, the Nordic upper class, being the rulers, were protected from field labour and thus survived as an aristocracy. In peaceful times, therefore, the Nordics multiplied and repaired the gaps wrought by proscription and war. The Industrial Revolution, however, profoundly modified this state of things. Europe was transformed from an agricultural to an urbanized industrial area. Numberless cities and manufacturing centers grew up, where men were closely packed and were subjected to all the evils of congested living. Of course, such conditions are not ideal for any stock. Nevertheless, the Nordic suffered more than anyone else. The cramped factory and the crowded city weeded out the big blonde Nordic with portentous rapidity, whereas the little brunette Mediterranean, in particular, adapted himself to the operative's bench or the clerk's stool. He prospered and reproduced his kind. The result of these new handicaps, combined with the continuance of the traditional handicaps, war and migration, has been a startling decrease of Nordics all over Europe throughout the 19th century, with a corresponding resurgence of the Alpine and still more of the Mediterranean elements. In the United States, it has been the same story. Our country, originally settled almost exclusively by Nordics, was towards the close of the 19th century invaded by hordes of immigrant Alpines and Mediterraneans, not to mention Asiatic elements like Levantines and Jews. As a result, the Nordic Native American has been crowded out with amazing rapidity by these swarming prolific aliens, and after two short generations, he has in many of our urban areas become almost extinct. The racial displacements induced by a changed economic or social environment are indeed almost incalculable. Contrary to the popular belief, nothing is more unstable than the ethnic makeup of a people. Above all, there is no more absurd fallacy than the shibboleth of the melting pot. As a matter of fact, the melting pot may mix, but it does not melt. Each race type, formed ages ago and set by millenniums of isolation and inbreeding, is a stubborn, persistent entity. Each type possesses a special set of characters, not merely the physical characters visible to the naked eye, but moral, intellectual, and spiritual characters as well. All these characters are transmitted substantially unchanged from generation to generation. To be sure, where members of the same race stock intermarry, as English and Swedish Nordics, or French and British Mediterraneans, there seems to be genuine amalgamation. In most other cases, however, the result is not a blend, but a mechanical mixture. Where the parent stocks are very diverse, as in matings between whites, Negroes and Amerindians, the offspring is a mongrel, a walking chaos, so consumed by his jarring heredities that he is quite worthless. We have already viewed the mongrel and his works in Latin America. Such are the two extremes. Where intermarriage takes place between stocks relatively near together, as in crossings between the main divisions of the white species, the result may not be bad and is sometimes distinctly good. Nevertheless, there is no true amalgamation. The different race characters remain distinct in the mixed offspring. If the race types have generally intermarried, the country is really occupied by two or more races, the races always tending to sort themselves out again as pure types by Mendelian inheritance. Now, one of these race types will be favoured by the environment, and it will accordingly tend to gain at the other's expense, while conversely, the other types will tend to be bred out and to disappear. Sometimes, a modification of the environment through social changes will suddenly reverse this process and will penalise a hitherto favoured type. We then witness a resurgence or increase of the previously submerged element. A striking instance of this is going on in England. England is inhabited by two race stocks, Nordics and Mediterraneans. Down to the 18th century, England, being an agricultural country with a cool climate, favoured the Nordics, and, but for the Nordic handicaps of war and migration, the Mediterraneans might have been entirely eliminated. 200 years ago, the Mediterranean element in England was probably very small. The Industrial Revolution, however, reversed the selective process, and today the small dark types in England increase noticeably with every generation. The Swart Cockney is a resurgence of the primitive Mediterranean stock and is probably a faithful replica of his ancestors of Neolithic times. Such was the ominous, seamy side of 19th century civilization. The regressive trend was, in fact, a vicious circle. An ill-balanced, faulty environment penalised the superior strains and favoured the inferior types, while conversely, the impoverishing race stocks, drained of their geniuses and overloaded with dullards and degenerates, were increasingly unable to evolve environmental remedies. Thus, by action and reaction, the situation grew steadily worse, disclosing its parlous state by numberless symptoms of social ill health, all the unlovely fin de siècle phenomena, such as the decay of ideals, rampant materialism, political disruption, social unrest, and the decadence of art and literature, were merely manifestations of the same basic ills. Of course, a thoughtful minority, undazzled by the prevalent optimism, pointed out these evils and suggested remedies. Unfortunately, these remedies were superficial because the reformers confused manifestations with causes and combated symptoms instead of fighting the disease. For example, the white world's troubles were widely ascribed to the loss of its traditional ideals, especially the decay of religious faith. But, as the Belgian sociologist René Girard acutely remarks, to reason in this manner is, we think, to mistake the effect for the cause. To believe that philosophic and religious doctrines create morals and civilizations is a seductive error, but a fatal one. To transplant the beliefs and institutions of a people to new regions, in the hope of transplanting thither their virtues and their civilization as well, is the vainest of follies. The greater or less degree of vigor in a people depends on the power of its vital instinct, of its greater or less faculty for adapting itself to and dominating the conditions of the moment. When the vital instinct of a people is healthy, it readily suggests to the people the religious and moral doctrines which assure its survival. It is not, therefore, because a people possesses a definite belief that it is healthy and vigorous, but rather because the people is healthy and vigorous, that it adopts or invents the belief which is useful to itself. In this way, it is not because it ceases to believe that it falls into decay. It is because it is in decay that it abandons the fertile dreams of its ancestors, without replacing this by a new dream, equally fortifying and creative of energy. Thus, we return once more to the basic principle of race. For what is vital instinct but the imperious urge of superior heredity? As Madison Grant well says, the lesson is always the same, namely that race is everything. Without race there can be nothing except the slave wearing his master's clothes, stealing his master's proud name, adopting his master's tongue, and living in the crumbling ruins of his master's palace. The disastrous consequences of failure to realize this basic truth is nowhere more strikingly exemplified than in the field of white world politics during the half century preceding the Great War. That period was dominated by two antithetical schools of political thinking, national imperialism and internationalism. Swayed by the ill-balanced spirit of the times, both schools developed extremist tendencies, the former producing such monstrous aberrations as pan-Germanism and pan-Slavism, the latter evolving almost equally vicious concepts like cosmopolitanism and proletarianism. The adherents of these rival schools combated one another and wrangled among themselves. They both disregarded the basic significance of race, together with its immediate corollary, the essential solidarity of the white world. As a matter of fact, white solidarity has been one of the great constants of history. For ages, the white peoples have possessed a true symbiosis, or common life, ceaselessly mingling their bloods and exchanging their ideas. Accordingly, the various white nations, which are the race's political expression, may be regarded as so many planets gravitating around the sun of a common civilization. No such sustained and intimate race solidarity has ever before been recorded in human annals. Not even the solidarity of the yellow peoples is comparable in scope. Of course, the white world's internal frictions have been legion, and at certain times these frictions have become so acute that white men have been led to disregard or even to deny their fundamental unity. This is perhaps also because white solidarity is so pervasive that we live in it, and thus ordinarily do not perceive it any more than we do the air we breathe. Should white men ever really lose their instinct of race solidarity, they would asphyxiate racially as swiftly and as surely as they would asphyxiate physically if the atmospheric oxygen should suddenly be withdrawn. However, down to 1914 at least, the white world never came within measurable distance of this fatal possibility. On the contrary, the white peoples were continually expressing their fundamental solidarity by various unifying concepts, like the Pax Romana of antiquity, the Civitas Dei, or Christian Commonwealth of the Middle Ages, and the European concert of 19th century diplomacies. It was typical of the malaise which was overtaking the white world that the close of the 19th century should have witnessed an ominous ignoring of white solidarity, that national imperialists should have breathed mutual slaughter, while internationalists caressed visions of human solidarity, culminating in universal race amalgamation. Lastly, that Asia's incipient revolt against white supremacy, typified by the Russo-Japanese War, should have found zealous white sponsors and abettors. Nothing, indeed, better illustrates the white world's unsoundness at the beginning of the present century than its reaction to the Russo-Japanese conflict. The tremendous significance of that event was no more lost upon the whites than it was upon the coloured peoples. Most far-seeing white men recognised it as an omen of evil import for their race future. And yet, even in the first access of apprehension, these same persons generally admitted that they saw no prospect of healing, constructive action to remedy the ills which were driving the white world along the downward path. Analysing the possibility of Europe's presenting a common front to the perils disclosed by the Japanese victories, the French publicist René Pignon sadly concluded in the negative, believing that political passions, social hates, and national rivalries would speak louder than the general interest. Contemporary Europe, he wrote in 1905, is probably not ready to receive and understand the lesson of the war. What are the examples of history to those gigantic commercial houses, uneasy for their New Year's balances, which are our modern nations? It is in the nature of states founded on mercantilism to content themselves with a hand-to-mouth policy, without general views or idealism, satisfied with immediate gains and unable to prepare against a distant future. Whence, in the Europe of today, could come the principle of an entente, and on what could it be based? Too many divergent interests, too many rival ambitions, too many festering hates, too many dead who speak, are present to stifle the voice of Europe's conscience. However menacing the external danger, we fear that political rancors would not down, that the enemy from without would find accomplices, or at least unconscious auxiliaries within. Far more than in its regiments and battleships, the power of Japan lies in our discords, in the absence of an ideal capable of lifting the European peoples above the daily pursuit of immediate interests, capable of stirring their hearts with the thrill of a common emotion. The true yellow peril lies within us. René Pignon was a true prophet. Not only was the writing on the wall not taken to heart, the decade following the Russo-Japanese conflict witnessed the prodigious aggravation of all the ills which had afflicted white civilization during the 19th century. As if scourged by a tragic fate, the white world hurtled along the downward path until it entered the fell shadow of the modern Peloponnesian War. The Peloponnesian War was the suicide of Greek civilization. It is the saddest page of history. In the brief Periclean epoch preceding the catastrophe, Hellas has shone forth with unparalleled splendour, and even those wonderful achievements seemed but the prelude to still loftier heights of glory. On the eve of its self-immolation, the Greek race, far from being exhausted, was bubbling over with exuberant vitality and creative genius. But the half-blown rose was nipped by the canker of discord. Jealous rivalries and mad ambitions smouldered till they burst into a consuming flame. For a generation, Hellas tore itself to pieces in a delirium of fratricidal strife, and even this was not the worst. The peace, which closed the Peloponnesian War, was no peace. It was a mere truce, dictated by the victors of the moment to sullen and vengeful enemies, imposed by the sword, and infused with no healing or constructive virtue. The Peloponnesian War was but the first of a war cycle which completed Hellas's ruin. The irreparable disaster had, indeed, occurred. The gulfs of sundering hatred had become fixed, and the sentiment of Greek race unity was destroyed. Having lost its soul, the Greek race soon lost its body as well. Drained of its best strains, the diminished remnant bowed to foreign masters and bastardized its blood with the hordes of inferior aliens who swarmed into the land. By the time of the Roman conquest, the Greeks were degenerate, and the Roman epithet Graeculus was a term of deserved contempt. Thus perished the Greeks, the fairest slip that ever budded on the tree of life. They perished by their own hands, in the flower of their youth, carrying with them to the grave unborn potencies which might have blessed and brightened the world for ages. Nature is inexorable. No living being stands above her law. And protozoan or demigod, if they transgress, alike must die. The Greek tragedy should be a warning to our own day. Despite many unlikenesses, the 19th century was strangely reminiscent of the Periclean age. In creative energy and fecund achievement, surely, its like had not been seen since the glory that was Greece, and the way seemed opening to yet higher destinies. But the brilliant sunrise was presently dimmed by gathering clouds. The birth of the 20th century was attended with disquieting omens. The ills which had afflicted the preceding epoch grew more acute, synchronizing into an all-pervading militant unrest. The spirit of change was in the air. Ancient ideals and shibboleths withered before the fiery breath of a destructive criticism, while the solid crust of tradition cracked and heaved under the premonitory tremors of volcanic forces working far below. Everywhere was seen, bursting forth increasingly, acute eruptions of human energy, a triumph for the dynamic over the static elements of life, a growing preference for violent and revolutionary, as contrasted with peaceful and evolutionary solutions, running the whole politico-social gamut from imperialism to syndicalism. Everywhere could be discerned the spirit of unrest, setting the stage for the great catastrophe. Grave disorders were simply inevitable. They might, perhaps, have been localized. They might even have taken other forms. But the ills of our civilization were too deep-seated to have avoided grave disturbances. The Prussian plotters of Weltermacht did indeed precipitate the impending crisis in its most virulent and concentrated form. Yet, after all, they were but sublimations of the abnormal trend of the time. The best proof of this is the white world's acutely pathological condition during the entire decade previous to the Great War. That fierce quest after alliances and mad piling up of armaments, those paroxysmal crises which racked diplomacy's feverish flame, those ferocious struggles which desolated the Balkans. What were all these but symptoms denoting a consuming disease? Today, by contrast, we think of the Great War as having smitten a world basking in profound peace. What a delusion! Cast back the mind's eye and recall how hectic was the eve of the Great War, not merely in politics, but in most other fields as well. Those opening months of 1914, why, Europe seethed from end to end. When the Great War began, England was on the verge of civil strife. Russia was in the throes of an acute social revolt. Italy had just passed through a red week threatening anarchy, and every European country was suffering from grave internal disorders. It was a strange, nightmarish time, that early summer of 1914, today quite overshadowed by subsequent events, but which later generations will assign a proper place in the chain of world history. Well, Armageddon began and ran its horrid course. With the grim chronology of those dreary years, this podcast is not concerned. It is with the aftermath that we deal here, and that is a sufficiently gloomy theme. The material losses are prodigious, the vital losses appalling, while the spiritual losses have well-nigh bankrupted the human soul. Grave as is the situation, it is not yet irreparable, any more than Greece's condition was hopeless after Aegios Potami. It was not the Peloponnesian War which sealed Hellas's doom, but the cycle of political anarchy and moral chaos of which the Peloponnesian War was merely the opening phase. Our world is too vigorous for even the Great War of itself to prove a mortal wound. The White World thus still has its choice, but it must be a positive choice. Decisions, firm decisions must be made. Constructive measures, drastic measures must be taken. Above all, time presses on, and the drift is fatal. The tide ebbs. The swimmer must put forth strong strokes to reach the shore. Else, swift oblivion waits in the dark ocean.